Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
You know those cravings that hit you out of nowhere? Charred steak tacos, silky mushroom risotto, or a perfect summer salad. When the craving hits, CookUnity delivers. Made with real ingredients and no shortcuts. CookUnity was made for adventurous eaters. With 160-plus award-winning chefs curating an ever-expanding menu of small batch meals. Get ready-to-eat meals delivered directly to your door, all tailored to your lifestyle, dietary needs, and cravings. Their roster of Food Network alums, James Beard Award winners, and acclaimed restaurateurs balance bold flavors and nutrition in their handcrafted meals, which are freshly prepared, delivered to your door, and never frozen. Get what you're craving. Try the freshest, best-tasting meal delivery made by your favorite celebrity chefs. Go to cookunity.com/crave or enter code CRAVE before checkout for free premium meals for life. That's free premium meals for life at cookunity.com/crave.
You're listening to the Preacher's Side Chick Murder Trial of Latasha Daniels from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.
Jurors are in the courtroom, Your Honor.
I'm almost there. We talked a little bit about suicide kind of being inwardly directed self-harm, right?
That's right.
Would you agree that the actions of driving 2 hours after buying a gun, showing up to Mr. Perry's house because you're upset he's trying to end a relationship, and committing a homicide is not inwardly directed, that's outwardly directed rage?
I don't think I can give you an expert opinion about that because I don't know enough information about what was going on in terms of the person's mental state that you're talking about.
But you testify in legal proceedings often, right?
That's correct.
Or deal with the legal system often. Is there anything about a murder-suicide plot where I'm going to kill somebody and then kill myself that would diminish the mental state, the intent, the premeditation that would be required to commit premeditated murder?
Can you ask me that in a different way?
I don't know how to ask that in a different way.
Can you ask me again?
Yes.
Okay.
So if an individual were planning to kill someone and then kill themselves, is there anything about that their actions toward the person that they were going to kill that would make them legally not responsible, legally not the legal mental state required to form the intent to kill somebody and the planning and premeditation that was required to do that.
It is possible that someone could engage in a homicide-suicide and not have the mental state required for the crime.
It's possible, but it's also possible that they could. Am I correct?
That's right.
Just the fact that you're suicidal does not mean that you don't have the mental state or the ability, the judgment and the ability to premeditate and plan a crime.
Simply being suicidal does not mean that you would not be able to form the intent.
You talked about childhood abuse. Does that, the fact that someone went through some trauma or a bad childhood, does that, anything about that prevent someone from forming intent to kill somebody and planning to do the kill? Just in and of itself.
Again, these are questions, this is a question that I probably can't answer truthfully in a yes or no, because it's more complicated than that. It depends. There are lots of things that trauma can cause in terms of mental health problems that could absolutely impact someone's ability to form intent.
But it doesn't necessarily.
That's
so
correct.
Every person that was abused as a child can't just go out and kill somebody and claim, I don't have the requisite mental intent to be convicted of that crime.
I suppose they could claim it. I don't know that it would be supported.
And the fact that someone was in failed relationships or married more than once, does that, or went through a divorce, does that in and of itself mean that that person is not responsible for their criminal action?
Again, the not responsible part is a legal decision. What I can say as a psychological expert is that would not mean the person necessarily would be unable to form an intent for a crime.
And I think you make a good point there. You're not a legal expert, correct?
That's correct.
You've offered an opinion based upon a clinical diagnosis.
In this evaluation, my opinions were essentially clinical diagnoses, kind of what her mental health was around the time.
You're not offering an opinion as to whether she met the legal definition of premeditation required for first-degree murder, though, are you?
That's correct. I'm not offering an opinion about that.
And you were not able to find criteria that she met the definition for insanity?
That's correct.
You were not able to find the criteria that she met the legal criteria for diminished capacity?
That's something I did not offer an opinion about.
In fact, you say in your report that you're unable to offer an opinion regarding her mental state at the time of the offense.
That's correct.
So you can't say that she didn't act intentionally.
That's correct.
And you can't say that she didn't premeditate this homicide.
That's correct. I did not offer opinions about either one of those things.
That's all.
Rita Root.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Dr. Betty, I want to touch on a couple things that Mr. McAlpin was speaking about with you, okay?
Okay.
First, I wanted to cue in on something that you said to him during direct, talking about suicidal individuals, and you had said someone can truly want to die, but still hope that someone else could give them a reason to live. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Can you kind of elaborate on that for me?
Yes, in my experience, in my clinical work, I often work with people that have kind of chronic suicidal ideation. And it's very common for people to consider suicide when they become hopeless and feel like they don't know any other way out and still want a way out. So it's, again, there's ambiguity there a lot of the time. They want to die and I think they're open to being helped if someone can help them.
Did Ms. Daniels endorse that kind of mentality to you about this incident?
Yes.
Clinically speaking, is someone who has attempted suicide more likely to attempt suicide again?
Yes.
Now, people who commit suicide or attempt to commit suicide have to take actions to do that, right?
That's right.
So you can have sequential and goal-oriented actions moving towards a suicide.
That's correct.
You could procure a weapon or other means by which to actually affect the death, right?
That's right.
And that means you could go buy a gun to kill yourself.
That's right.
You can choose a place to commit suicide.
Yes.
You can drive to that place to commit suicide.
Yes.
You can plan out what you want to say to your family in a suicide note.
Yes.
Are all of those plans that you're making?
Yes, that is all planful behavior.
Is that the result of reasoned judgment when you're dealing with a suicidal person?
I think that's a controversial answer. People who want to commit suicide have reasons for wanting to commit suicide. At the same time, like I said, often those people get there because they feel like there's no other option. And research relates that to depression, which kind of lowers our ability to think through our options and make decisions like we would when we're not depressed.
The ability to make sound and reasoned judgments, right?
I would agree with that. I think it depends on how we define sound and reasoned.
Severe depression that can result in those suicidal ideations, suicide attempts, or accomplished suicides. Severe depression, does it necessarily affect your basic ability to make and execute plans?
It does not necessarily affect that ability.
Does it affect the quality of your decision making?
Yes, I think that's fair.
Does severe depression affect your decision-making process?
Yes. Depression kind of slows down everything, including your ability to think.
So severe depression can actually affect all of your thought processes?
It can.
Can mental health issues affect your judgment and reflection ability?
Yes.
What is the difference between suicidality and, or suicidal ideations and homicidal ideations?
Suicidal ideations are thoughts about wanting to kill yourself. Homicidal ideations are thoughts about wanting to kill someone else.
Does someone who has suicidal ideations necessarily have homicidal ideations?
No.
Does someone who has homicidal ideations necessarily have suicidal ideations?
No.
Those two things can exist separately.
That's correct.
And oftentimes do.
That's correct.
When you evaluated Ms. Daniels, did you find her to have a history of suicidal ideations?
Yes.
And aside from this instant conduct, did you see her to have a history of homicidal ideations?
No.
When you're dealing with severe depression and mental health issues, can those issues affect the way an individual responds to emotional triggers?
Yes.
How?
If you're depressed, for example, or if you have other mental health problems going on, the way I think about it is that it makes you vulnerable. It kind of raises your it's easier, right? It's easier to react in an extreme way if your stress or your mental health is not doing well. It takes less to get a more kind of extreme reaction.
So can it affect your reason ability in the face of that trigger?
Yes.
Can it affect your ability to make decisions?
Yes.
Your ability to make well-reasoned decisions?
Yes.
Now, when, towards the end of when you were talking with Mr. McAlpin after lunch, you were saying suicide on its own is not necessarily indicative of things. Is suicidality usually indicative of a larger mental health issue?
It can be. Certainly if it's something that comes up during times when there are other mental health symptoms like depressive symptoms, there are some people that suicide comes up for them like once in their life because they're really stressed out or there's just a lot of things going on in their life. But in general, if someone is suicidal, it certainly raises the suspicion that there's a mental health problem going on.
And there's a whole spectrum of suicidalness, right? You have some people who could have a terminal degenerative disease that are choosing conscientiously to end their lives versus someone in a mental health crisis who takes their own lives.
That's right.
There's a whole spectrum.
Yes.
But oftentimes, wanting to commit suicide, those suicidal ideations are indicative of an underlying mental health issue.
Yes.
The suicidal ideation itself, is that its own mental health issue? Or is it a symptom?
I think both. We would treat, even if someone didn't meet like a diagnosis for a mental health problem, the suicidal ideation would still be something that could be treated and addressed.
And it should be treated and addressed, right? That's a concerning symptom. Now I want to talk to you about when Mr. McAlpin was discussing your prior testimony experience, okay? You indicated that you have testified more for the defense.
That's right? Correct.
Now, when you and I were speaking earlier, you talked about this, a not guilty by reason of insanity defense is extremely rare.
Yes.
How many evaluations do you think you have done?
Evaluations specifically to?
Forensic evaluations.
At this point in my career, well over 800.
Okay. How many times have you found someone to meet the threshold of not guilty by reason of insanity?
Less than
me or her. Okay, I'll be louder. He was saying he couldn't hear me.
Okay. All right.
Of the 800 evaluations, how many times have you found individuals to be not guilty by reason of insanity?
Less than 2% of those evaluations.
It's an extremely high standard.
Yes, it's difficult to meet.
And Ms. Daniels did not meet that standard, right?
It's my opinion she would not meet that standard.
Okay. In your practice as a forensic psychologist, this is what you do. You said you've done over 800 evaluations, right?
That's correct.
Oftentimes, when you end up at a trial, it's because someone was found not guilty by reason of insanity, in your opinion, right?
If I end up at trial, it typically isn't for not guilty by reason of insanity. There's only been one instance in my career where I've testified at a trial for that purpose.
Was that for the defense or for the state?
For the state.
Okay. Of the 800 evaluations, are most of those court appointed?
Yes.
Is that usually state oriented? Are you usually hired separately by the defense?
Most of my work, I'm appointed by the court, so I'm not hired by defense or prosecution. When I am hired privately, well, when I'm hired by one party or the other, it is typically that I'm hired by the defense.
The state kind of already has you at access through Vanderbilt, right?
Through the court-ordered process, yes.
Now, I want to talk to you about when Mr. McAlpin was discussing your basis of information, okay?
Okay.
You only met with Ms. Daniels one time.
That's right.
Is that normal for your evaluations to only meet with the person one time?
It's not uncommon, certainly. I think for these evaluations, it's typically 1 to 2 meetings.
And is that the same whether you're testifying for the defense or for the state?
Yes.
In either instance, do you blindly rely on self-reporting?
No. Again, the idea is that there needs to be other data that would support what the defendant is telling me.
And did you look for that other data here?
Yes.
And you found Tabitha Perry's statement?
Correct.
Did you believe it corroborated what Ms. Daniels told you?
Yes.
You read police reports?
Yes.
Did you believe that corroborated what Ms. Daniels told you?
In a sense, she wasn't able to remember a lot of what was actually in police reports, meaning like what was mostly in police reports is what they observed when they got to the scene. And she's saying that she doesn't remember a lot of what happened during the incident and immediately after. So in that sense, no. But the things that she did remember, those were consistent with.
Did the police reports corroborate mental health concerns for you?
The police reports confirmed that she was pointing a gun at her head and was then shortly after arrest indicating that she wanted to kill herself.
The receipts that you saw corroborated the timeline that she gave you.
That's right.
The suicide note corroborated those suicidal ideations she talked to you about.
That's right.
The video of Protus Perry talking about seeing her at the cigar lounge corroborated her timeline of events for you.
That's right.
Did you find Ms. Daniels to be a woman who suffers from mental illness?
Yes.
Did you find that she is a woman who has suffered from mental illness for a long time?
I know I'm being nitpicky here. For a long time, I can say that she was endorsing depressive symptoms for at least 2 years before the offense happened.
And even all the way back to the end of her first marriage, right? With that first suicide attempt.
That's right.
So that takes us back to like a 10-year period of time, right?
That's true.
What was the overriding emotion endorsed by Ms. Daniels when you met with her?
The overriding emotion she endorsed around the time of the offense was sadness, hopelessness.
When you talked about defensive avoidance, what do you mean by defensive?
Defensive in that context is talking about how our brain naturally tries to defend us against traumatic things. So avoiding thoughts of a scary memory is a type of like mental defense.
Is that different than someone behaving defensively? Like that almost kind of reaction?
Yes.
And in speaking with Ms. Daniels, she talked to you about the fact that she was always expected to put on a happy face, right?
That's right.
No matter what was going on inside of her.
That's right.
And that had been her reality since she was a child.
Yes.
I want to talk to you now about something you and Mr. McAlpin discussed regarding impulsivity. Can you talk to me a little bit more about what impulsivity is?
Impulsivity is when somebody acts quickly in the heat of a moment. Sometimes when you hear impulsivity, people say it's like acting without thinking. But typically it's acting really quickly, like unexpectedly, in the heat of a moment.
And how does impulsivity tie to mental health issues?
There are mental health issues that include impulsivity, and it's not necessarily it's a symptom of a few, but not necessarily common across all mental health disorders.
Is it associated with depressive disorders?
Not typically.
Okay. What was the context of the impulsivity when you were speaking with Mr. McAlpin?
I don't remember.
Okay. Did you find any impulsivity issues with Ms. Daniels in her reasoning?
Can Can you rephrase that?
That was a poorly worded question. I apologize.
Does impulsivity affect decision making?
If somebody is like an impulsive person, typically that means that they make poor decisions and again react without a whole lot of thought about consequences.
Can impulsivity be associated with suicidal attempts or suicidal ideations?
Yes. The research that's out there about completed suicides, people that attempt and they end up dying, typically that is related to impulsivity. Most of the time suicidal acts are impulsive.
I'm going to shift gears for just a minute. In assessing Ms. Daniels, did Latasha endorse feelings of remorse about what happened?
Yes.
Significant remorse?
Yes.
Now, last thing I want to talk to you about. As a psychologist, you meet with people and discuss the most intimate parts of their lives, right?
More so in my clinical work than my forensic work, but yes.
You find out the most personal details of people.
Yes.
Is that a relationship that has to be based on trust?
I would say in the clinical sense, yes. In a forensic evaluation, it's difficult to build trust in a matter of a few hours. And it's not a priority in forensic evaluations for there to be trust there. But absolutely, in a clinical sense, yes, trust is very important.
Because in that context, the person with whom you are dealing is extraordinarily vulnerable.
Yes.
And they have completely opened themselves up to you.
Yes. As far as I know.
That's all I have.
Any recross?
No, ma'am.
You must sit down, ma'am. All right, jurors, we just take a short break. So we'll reconvene shortly. So I'm going to show you excuse this time. And remember, we're still not ready to discuss the case.
Folks, be sure to pass your chair.
So excited when you finally tell them that they can talk about it.
All right, so just let me know.
Could just step out.
All right, I'll give you some time. All right, we'll take a recess. Let me swear him in. All right. You can raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will take charge of this jury, that you will keep them separate and apart from all persons, that you will not allow them to communicate in any manner with anyone nor anyone with them, and as it concerns the matter on trial, nor with you nor you with them, and that you will deliver them safely into court, so help you God.
I do.
All right, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, we can take a recess.
What's in recess?
Put her in the stand for everything.
Okay. All right, Ms. Daniels, you can come around.
This is yours. Raise your right hand.
Do you swear, affirm, and tell the whole truth?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, you can have a seat, ma'am.
Watch your step.
Would you please state and spell your name?
Latasha Daniels, LATOSHIADANIELS.
Now, Ms. Daniels, what you are doing right now is called a moment hearing, okay?
Okay.
And what that means is that we are talking about your rights and your decisions, okay?
Okay.
You have an absolute right not to testify. Do you understand that?
Yes.
That's called the right against self-incrimination. Do you understand that?
Yes.
You have the right not to give proof in a case against you. Have we discussed that right?
Yes, we have.
Do you understand that if you decided to remain silent, the judge would tell the jury that they cannot hold that against you?
Yes.
Do you understand that you also have an absolute right to testify?
Yes.
And that this is one of the few decisions that is yours and yours alone, right?
Yes.
Mr. Horn and I cannot make this decision for you. Do you understand that?
I do understand.
Have you spoken with myself and Mr. Horn, though, about this decision?
I have.
Have you been present throughout all of the trial?
I have.
Have you been able to hear and observe all of the witnesses?
I have.
Have you been able to see all of the exhibits?
I have.
Are you aware not only of the proofs that's come forward at trial, but also of all of the discovery in your case?
I am aware of all of it.
Have you discussed that discovery and the evidence with both me and Mr. Horn?
I have.
Have you discussed the charges against you?
I have.
You understand you're charged with first-degree murder?
Yes.
Have you and I discussed the elements of first-degree murder?
Yes.
Do you understand that the state has to prove each of those elements beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes.
Do you understand all of the elements of criminal attempt first-degree murder?
Yes.
Do you understand that the state has to prove all of those elements beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes.
Do you understand the elements required for employing a firearm during a felony?
Yes.
Do you understand the state has to prove all of those beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes.
Do you understand the elements and understand the burden of proof?
Yes.
And even this was a superseding indictment, right?
Yes.
And you and I had discussed previously the issues in the old indictment.
Correct.
And we discussed how the new indictment kind of changed some things, right?
Yes.
You've had several discussions throughout this entire process with your whole defense team, right?
Yes.
We have prepared for trial together.
We have.
We prepared specifically regarding your testimony.
Yes.
After everything that you've heard, everything that we've discussed, and everything that you've considered, have you made a decision on whether or not you want to testify?
I have.
What is that decision?
I choose to testify.
Thank you.
You may step down. I thought the defendant is knowingly and voluntarily made a decision to testify. Is there anything you need to address before the jury comes in? No? All right, we can get the jury in.
Will we take a break to discuss instructions?
Yes.
Jurors are entering the courtroom, Your Honor.
case you might call your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. The defense calls Latasha Daniels.
You can raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm and tell the whole truth?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, you may have a seat.
Can you please state and spell your name?
Latasha, Latoshia, Daniels, Daniels.
Before we get into all of the allegations here, have you ever testified in a situation like this before?
No.
Is this a comfortable situation?
Not at all.
Please let me know if you need anything. I want to talk to you about, first, your childhood. Your childhood, okay?
Okay.
Can you tell me about your parents?
My parents, my father was retired military and a minister, and my mom, she was my mother.
Was your biological father the man that you called dad?
No. I was raised by my stepfather, and so I called him father, and my biological father I called papa.
Now, the dad that you lived with, right? Mm-hmm. What did he do for a living?
Once he retired from the military, he was... From my knowledge, he worked at M.M. Cones, and he retired from there. And then he began to work for the Salvation Army, where he ran the community community center where the youth would go. And so once he retired from there, he was just home sitting on the porch and buying land and doing gardens.
At any point, did he become an ordained minister?
He did. I was in elementary, but I do recall him becoming an ordained minister.
What would you consider his reputation to have been within your community?
He was highly respected in our community. Everyone knew of my father and respected him well.
And did they know that you were your father's daughter?
Oh, yes, to the point to where, if anybody seen my sisters and I, they would say, that's Mr. Briggs' daughters. They knew that who we were.
Did that mean something in that community to be his daughter?
Most definitely, and we carried ourselves accordingly.
Now, how were things at home outside of public?
Things at home wasn't as what they seemed in public. My father did physically abuse my mother, and I was the one who would at nights wake up and beg him to stop.
Did you have any siblings in the home?
I did. I had two little sisters.
Did the three of you hear as your dad would beat your mom?
I'm not sure if they did, but I did, and I often would wake up and ask him to stop, and even sometimes try pulling them apart.
When you were in public, did you let that side of your life show?
Oh, not at all. I went to school and I did the things that I was supposed to do, participated in sports and just carried myself, I guess, in a normal fashion.
Is that what was expected of you?
Yes, we didn't say or tell what was going on inside of the home.
Now I want to talk to you about late in your teens, okay? Mm-hmm. When you were 17, you got pregnant.
I did.
What happened when you got pregnant?
I shared with my dad. Well, I don't know if I shared with him or not, but I was told once he found out that I needed to get married.
Did you get married?
I did.
And was that to Rodney?
Yes.
How would you describe your relationship with Rodney?
In the beginning, it was good. We both had graduated from high school, and so we was building a life together. We moved from our hometown to Little Rock, Arkansas, and purchased a home, and we were doing well. Rodney decided to go to police academy, and during that time, I helped him. I made sure he studied. I did everything that I could to ensure that he made it through police academy and was successful. Once he, probably months after joining the force, things began to shift. He would ask me to do certain things that I was like out of the norm, but I was in college, and so he would then say, well, you're probably going to want somebody from college. And I didn't understand that, because like, I loved Rodney. I wanted our family. But even though we didn't argue, we grew distant, and I never understood why until I found out that he was having an affair.
Did you actually catch him in the act?
Not in the beginning, but during, he decided that we was gonna separate, and one day while I was at school, he had packed up all my stuff, put it in a U-Haul, and drove it to my mom's house.
How long were you married to Robbie?
For 4 years.
Did you eventually get divorced?
We did.
Okay. Now, after that divorce, did you attempt suicide?
I actually did it right before we actually finalized the divorce.
Did you commit suicide because of the divorce? I'm sorry, attempt to commit suicide because of the divorce.
Yes, I just didn't feel like I felt like a failure. That was the one thing. I felt like a failure. I didn't think that I was enough. And so I didn't feel I had anything to offer.
But you did go on to get an education, right?
I did.
And you didn't let your divorce or your teen pregnancy, you didn't let those things stop you from trying to get better in your life, right?
Right. I wanted to push forward. I wanted to be successful. And I mean, I had to be. So I kept going.
And you eventually became a licensed clinical social worker.
I did.
Now, I want to talk to you about your second marriage, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That was to Brian.
Yes.
Now, how long were you married to Brian?
I was married to Brian for 8 years.
Was that relationship positive?
No.
Did you feel loved in that relationship?
No.
Did you feel wanted in that relationship?
Not at all.
Would you describe Brian as being emotionally distant?
He very much was so.
Emotionally neglectful?
Yes.
Did you try to get Brian to go into marriage counseling?
Yes, we had a discussion and he didn't want to do it.
Did you determine that you would go get your own counseling?
Yes.
Did you go see a psychologist?
I did not.
Why?
Because of the field that I was in, I just wanted, one, I wanted spiritual guidance, but also because of me being in private practice, I was afraid of being that individual that was getting the water cooler talk, per se. Just in my field, I didn't have anyone that I felt like I could really go to and trust, because I was very closed off. I didn't share my business with anybody. And so going through that and being in private practice, I didn't want to take what was my income, because I needed to be able to take care of the things in my life. So I did not. But I did know that spiritually I wanted some direction.
Why did you feel like you needed spiritual direction?
Just from my first, from my first marriage, when I went to my dad and told him that I was getting a divorce, the one thing he said to me that just resonated with me was that he said he would have gotten an attorney.
There's more of the Preacher's Side Chick murder trial of Latasha Daniels coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to care for yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps, ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today for 10% off your first month.